Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Down the Tube with Miss Darkholm, Legend of the Dodo, Gigantic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and of course, the croc that ran with hooves. We are going down the tube, as always, here on Down the Tube is brought to you by a team of voices. A team of voices is a group located on allpoetry.com, the largest poetry site in the world. And I always like to say thank you to Kevin and his crew for keeping the site up and running and giving us a place to share our poetry. Also, thank you to Deborah Lee for running the group and the blog talk page so we can geek out live. A special thanks to AP Taylor for sponsoring the blog talk page. And we have shows every night of the week with different hosts, different themes. And it's really fun. Stop on by, knock on the door. We'll let you in. You can follow along with the poems, drop your own poems and your own insight, and give us a bit of a visit. As always, promised on these once-a-month shows, we go anywhere. So we have three topics that I focused on, I mentioned earlier. I hope you guys have fun. I have some poems, some sound clips of poetry as well. We opened with Erutin, who I feature a lot because I just love her. And a little bit about her, in her own words, my mother was a private classical violin teacher who taught lessons in our home. There was never a moment where I wasn't listening to music of her students or vinyl records and classics. I was presented with and started playing my first violin at age 1.5, and it was a size 1/32 size, which is the smallest practical size of violin available. I broke it within a day, but that was to be expected. What was not expected was my taking to the instrument for real life and learning very fast. I mimicked my mother's students, and I learned pieces that they played while still in diapers. We have a few precious videos of this, which I will have to bring out someday to share. So I hope you liked hearing a little bit about her. I really love her music. I know she's taken a back seat for a little while. I think she has more on her page about her vocal cords giving her a bit of a hard time. But she has tons of sessions of cosplay videos. It's really nice. This one, the Jabberwocky, has a cosplay video. I really loved it. You should really check it out on YouTube. All right. I don't think I mentioned it. I'm your host, Sky. I'm still getting that a team of voices thing down. I'm going to have to, I don't know. I'm going to have to figure it out. But I do want to give a disclaimer for tonight. As many of you who might listen to the shows regularly, I did cancel my storyboards last week because I was sick. I am still recovering. I'm still having a little bouts of coughing, so if I go mute all of a sudden, it's probably because I'm coughing, and my wonderful right-hand, official right-hand man might step in at those times if I'm on mute. I'm so grateful. If I'm muted for a long period of time, if it's not, wait a moment, I'll be back. And with that said, hello, Rack.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm not coughing at the moment. So I am ready, willing, and able to jump right in as long as the stupid radio doesn't lag and make me step on you.
You know, it might happen. I mean, I did pause during that intro, so I think it'll be okay. I have some tea here. I did not want to cancel again because I've been waiting for the show for a while. I really just wanted to talk about the dodo bird. So, I mean, I like the other ones too, but I was really waiting for the dodo bird show. I've had this up for 3 months. So,
the dodo bird holds a special place in history and in folklore. So yeah,
it does. And of course, you know, where I had first heard of the dodo bird, of course, would be Lewis Carroll, right? Alice in Wonderland. So I remember when I was little, I really loved it. So with that said, as well. I do have poems that are Lewis Carroll poems. So we're going to have some. I thought that not only were they, because of the dodo bird, but also he has a poem called The Crocodile, and we are going to be celebrating the croc that ran on hooves. Can you imagine a giant crocodile running after you with hooves?
I'm more afraid of that.
I don't know. And then I do have a mouse poem. I couldn't find, one of giant animal. Well, I guess the Jabberwocky is a giant animal, right? But I do have a little bit of giant beasts and where to find them, which is obviously a spin on Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But we'll be talking about huge hamsters and giant owls. But I did bring a mouse poem from Lewis Carroll. I've got a couple things from Lewis Carroll. But you know how I just love talking about those gigantic animals? I've done a lot of them. I think I've done, the snake. I've done, I can't even remember how many I've done. We've got that. And then, of course, the dodo bird. All right. And I have all the clips here in the studio. So if you guys haven't had a chance to, watch the videos, then I've definitely, the clips or the videos, I've got them here for you. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and kick us off. So let's see. We're going to get kicked off with, I'm going to go the crocodiles, I think. I'm going to save the dodo birds for last. I think Deb might call. I'm not sure, but I know that she knows that I was super excited about that. So I'm thinking she may write about it, but I'm not sure. But here we go. Here's the crocodile on hooves, and then we can chat about it a little after. So enjoy.
Thanks to this month's Eontologists, Jake Hart, John Ivey, John Davison Ng, and Steve. In 1824, French naturalist Georges Cuvier became the first scientist to describe a strange specimen of an extinct crocodilian, but even he had no idea how truly odd this animal would turn out to be. The specimen was from central France and consisted of just a few teeth and bones, enough to tell that it was some kind of croc-like reptile, but one unlike any that had ever been discovered. Cuvier noted that the teeth were flat and serrated, completely different from the cone-shaped teeth found in modern crocodilians. This reptile seemed equipped more for biting through flesh than grabbing prey and pulling it into the water, as many crocodilians do today. Cuvier described this animal as the crocodile from the Marl of Argentan, which sounds a lot more regal in French. Today, the animal is known as Bovarisuchus, but it wasn't until almost two centuries later that the full body of this strange reptile was finally pieced together, revealing that those flat, sharp teeth belonged to one of the weirdest members of the order Crocodilia ever found. For one thing, its legs were much longer than those of most crocs today, and its hind legs were a lot longer than its front legs. Plus, instead of claws, its toes were each kept with hooves, much like those found in early horses at the time. So, yeah, there once was a crocodilian with hooves that could run down prey on land. And some researchers think that it had another, even stranger ability, although others aren't so sure. Now, how did this living nightmare, this crocodile from the Marl, come to evolve? Basically, it's the product of a whole lot of family competition. When I say Bovarisuchus was a crocodilian, I don't mean that it was a crocodile, but it was a member of the same order as crocodiles, which is known as Crocodilia. And anything within that order, including modern animals like alligators and caimans, are called crocodilians. And members of the order Crocodilia have been around in one form or another since the late Cretaceous, around 100 million years ago. But after the extinction event at the end of the Cretaceous, the non-avian dinosaurs and other large archosaurs were gone. And that's when crocodilians really began to diversify and flourish, taking on many of the niches that those animals had left empty. One such group of enterprising reptiles was the now extinct family known as Planocranidae, a group of crocodilians that are characterized by living mostly on land instead of in the water and having those strange blade-like teeth. Planocranidae first showed up in the Paleocene epoch about 61 million years ago, starting with a species from China known as Planocrania hengdongensis. But the family soon spread and diversified, and by the middle of the Eocene epoch, around 50 million years ago, its members could be found running around Germany and North America, including the most widespread of them all, Bovarosuchus. No matter where it lived, Bovarosuchus wasn't usually the only crocodilian around, and that might have been one of the driving evolutionary forces that turned it into the nightmare fodder that it became. After all, when a lot of carnivores are in the same place, it creates competition. And when that happens, sometimes you have to do something a little different to set yourself apart in order to survive. A good example of this phenomenon is recorded in the coal-bearing layers of the 48-million-year-old fossil site in Germany known as Geiseltal. This layer of swampy sediment preserves the bodies of four different genera of crocodilians in addition to Bovarosuchus. There was Asiaticus, which was nearly 3 meters long, the medium-sized Diplocynodon, and the tiny pug-faced Allognathosuchus at just over half a meter long. Studies of the teeth and skulls of these crocs showed that each genus had adapted to its own ecological niche. Asiaticus, for example, was the biggest and ate large fish and sometimes ambushed mammals that came to drink from the swamp. But Diplocynodon ate small fish and frogs, and Allognathosuchus was more likely eating small invertebrates like crayfish. But all three of these crocodilians were aquatic, or at least semi-aquatic. They had short legs and long fin-like tails. They weren't built for running after prey on land. And there were some predators on land, but not nearly as many as you might expect. 48 million years ago, bears, cats, and dogs hadn't evolved yet, which means that a large niche for a predator had been left empty. And the land was full of potential prey, from big terrestrial birds to little dog-sized horses. So any crocodilian that could take advantage of that wide-open niche on land would have a better chance of thriving, especially when there were already three other kinds of crocodilians patrolling the waterways. Okay, but then how did Bovarosuchus come to fill that niche? How did its ancestors become this running razor-toothed predator? Well, the fossil record doesn't really help us there. In the United States, Bovarosuchus shows up fully formed and ready to run in the early Eocene. It appears in the fossil record nearly simultaneously about 55 million years ago in Texas, Wyoming, and Utah before spreading to Europe. And there's no sign of the ancestor that would eventually lead to Bovarosuchus. But we can find clues to its origins by looking at some of its modern relatives. Because the fact is, not all modern crocodilians are bound to the water. Some of them still do hunt on land, like one known as the smooth-fronted caiman. This caiman isn't closely related to Bovarosuchus or the other planet cranids, but it does have a similar lifestyle. Not only does it tend to hunt on land, but, like Bovarosuchus, it can sprint for short distances. And it even has teeth that are a bit more blade-like than other crocodilians. So researchers think that whatever Bovarosuchus descended from probably looked and behaved a lot like today's smooth-fronted caiman. And that ancestor would have been primed for natural selection to increase its speed and biting power, making it better suited to life on land. Now, one key to that transition was in its teeth. Those flat, serrated teeth that Bovarosuchus and other planar cranids had are known as diphodont dentition, and it made a big difference in how they could take down big prey. Many modern crocodilians drag their prey underwater, so they have conical teeth that can clench their prey in their mouths as they drown it, which is not how I want to go. But terrestrial crocodilians needed sharp slicing teeth to help them inflict a lot of damage in single bites, killing their prey more quickly, which is not a better option. Now, another adaptation that gave this reptile a leg up for life on land was its strange legs. Like I mentioned before, the legs of Bovarosuchus were much longer than a typical crocodilian's, and its back legs were longer than its front legs. And this is where things get even more interesting, and pretty controversial. If you've ever heard of Bovarosuchus before, or heard of it by its other older name, Pristicensis, then you might have heard that this reptile had a very strange ability indeed. The ability to run on just two legs. On some TV shows and websites, it's been depicted as being facultatively bipedal, meaning that it could, at times, carry itself on its hind legs so it could run even faster on land. This ability was proposed by a researcher in Germany who thought that its unusually long back legs might have made this possible. After all, many reptiles with a body plan like this are capable of running on their hind legs, like basilisks and collared lizards. And if Bovarosuchus really could have run on two legs, I'd be the first to say that it would have made this animal even more terrifyingly awesome. Or awesomely terrifying? But we talked to a couple of experts who specialize in ancient crocodilians, including Dr. Christopher Brochu, who reclassified Pristicensis as Bovarosuchus. And he and others are not at all convinced. They argue that the limb proportions of this animal aren't nearly as extreme as they are in modern bipedal lizards, and that its center of mass was also too far forward for it to have been able to raise its upper body. So if Bovarosuchus wasn't bipedal, I'd have to say I'd be disappointed, but also somewhat relieved. And in any case, Bovarosuchus did have one more undisputed and equally unusual trait that helped it master life on dry land. Its hooves. Most crocodilians have pointy fingers that are tipped in claws, but the claws of Bovarosuchus were rounded and blunt, much like hooves. Pretty much the only difference between the hooves of Bovarosuchus and the hooves of its prey, like early horses, was that its hooves were a little narrower. So with its hooved hands and feet, it would have been much better at pushing off the ground and adding bursts of speed to catch its prey. And the fossil evidence suggests that these running crocodilians were quite good at what they did. Several horse fossils found at Geiseltal in the 1950s appear to have crocodilian teeth embedded in them. And at another site in Germany, there's even a primate jaw with bite marks and teeth that show evidence of going through the very acidic digestive tract of a crocodilian. But despite the many adaptations that Bovarsuchus had at its disposal, we don't have any toothy-hooved running crocodilians today. And I'm going to count that as a positive. The last of the planocranids, a species known as Bovarsuchus borax, went extinct between 40 million and 45 million years ago. It was, as they say, the end of an era, but also the beginning of a new abundance of mammalian predators. The earliest members of the order Carnivora prowled the land around this time, as did the creodonts, an odd group of mammals that seemed at once cat-like and dog-like, though they weren't actually related to either. It's not clear whether these warm-blooded animals outcompeted the running crocodilians, but it's possible. And a big environmental change was also underway in the last half of the Eocene, thanks to the chemistry of mountain building. Earlier in the Eocene, the collision of the Indian plate with the Eurasian plate created the Himalayas, and the slow weathering of these new mountains gradually removed carbon dioxide from the air. These and other plate movements also changed the circulation of air currents, and together these forces caused the climate to cool. Crocodilian ranges started to shrink, retreating from as far north as Wyoming to areas closer to the equator. So perhaps Bovarsuchus in cooler weather simply couldn't compete with all these new mammalian predators. Ancient crocodilians like Bovarsuchus owed much of their success to the competition that took place within their own family, which drove their evolutionary development after the extinction of the non-avian dinosaurs. In the case of Bovarsuchus, that resulted in a crocodilian that could run on land on hooved feet. But when faced with competition outside its family in a rapidly changing world, in the end, even this speedy reptile couldn't keep up. Thanks for joining me today.
Awesome. And thank you, PBS, for that public service announcement. I really love that PBS started doing those little, they're like little documentaries on YouTube. They're just, I mean, I've always liked documentaries, but I also like, like if I just don't know, I'm hard with commitment, you know, I can't commit to something too long these days. So when I look at the YouTube things, they're just short and nice. Sometimes I go in and I watch a really long one, but it's just so fun because they just have all these short clips about these animals and it's easy to digest. And if you have some time on your hands, but not a whole lot of time, you can just watch one at a time and not overfill your, you know, plate with too many things and you know, learn something new. So what do you think? Are you for that they can walk on their back legs, or are you against it?
I don't think they could. Based on the body mass and the center of gravity, probably not. But
yeah,
you know,
and I, a lot of... Go ahead, I'm sorry. I have a question when I cut you.
No, that's all right, because I got a controversial go back a half a step further and say, you know, who's to say, and I'm sure that they have proof of it, but, you know, that they didn't mix up the skeleton and find somebody else's legs mixed in with it, or someone, you know, some archaeologist is playing a joke and put the legs of something else in with the crocodile legs and say, let's see who we can get to believe that crocodiles had hooves, you know? I always wonder about stuff like that. I'm sure there's enough proof that you know conspiracy theorists be damned and you know, no, it's true. But you know, at the same time, I still have to wonder, because you know, the internet is a funny place.
Yeah, you can still wonder. I think it's good to ask questions. But I honestly, I agree with you. I find it hard to believe that they would be able to go on their hind legs. And again, it was someone just threw it out there, and you know, not everybody believes it. So I mean, there's a lot of proof against it. So I don't know. I mean, it would be cool. I have to tell you, not cool, but terrifying. Exactly what they said. To see this thing on its hind legs chasing you. Oh my gosh! I just think it's just so cool to think about what has existed before, you know. Yeah. So. All right. So I am going to go into the crocodile poem, if I can find it. Let's see.
Listen for the ticking.
That was
a Peter Pan reference, actually.
Yeah, that's what I was doing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were doing Jeopardy.
Song. No, I was doing do-do-do-do-do. That's the song they play in Peter Pan.
Okay.
For the song. Yeah.
My bad.
And then I was saying I was just watching that the other day, but I wasn't watching Peter Pan. I was watching Hook with Robin Williams.
The next generation of Peter Pan.
I love it. You know, I don't know where this crocodile. Oh, here we go. The crocodile. And this is read to you by Helena Bonham Carter. And I just love her. So I hope you enjoy.
The Crocodile by Lewis Carroll. How doth the little crocodile improve his shining tail and pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale? How cheerfully he seems to grin, how neatly spread his claws, and welcomes little fishies in with gently smiling jaws.
Isn't that a really nice, sweet little story?
Especially in her voice, yes.
I love her. I absolutely love her. Yeah. I just thought...
Go ahead. No, I just said, you said I love her. I said Bellatrix.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I've had my goddaughter over here for, last week, and we were on a movie marathon, and because there was no school on Veterans Day, we were both sick, so we just had a movie marathon, and we were watching Harry Potter, the one where Bellatrix Lestrange comes in. And, of course, like, she's trying to watch a movie, and I'm telling her all the trivia. we've already seen a lot of times. But I'm, like, telling her, I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm like, do you know whose wife that was? Like, because she knows who Tim Burton is. So I'm like, that was Tim Burton's wife. And she's like, really? And I'm like, yeah. And then I'm, like, telling her all these, like, tidbits and facts. And I'm like, you know, she wasn't really supposed to be Bellatrix Lestrange. The person who was supposed to be was Malfoy's mother. That was the actress they had cast, but then she couldn't do it in time, so that then they had to find somebody else. But they still wanted her to be part of it, so they had her come in later as the mother and like telling her all this stuff, and so she's just like listening to all my trivia. It's so funny. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I love that one. It's short, it's sweet. But I just love how it's like how cheerfully he grins, neatly spreads his claws, you know, he puts in that happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I had written part of my Fear series, Carlyle the Crocodile. And he was really nice, but he was afraid to smile because his teeth would scare everybody away, and he just wanted to be a friendly crocodile on him. So, there's that. This guy is not friendly, though. All right, what else we have? We opened with the Jabberwocky. So, I am going to play that one next. And it is, again, by Lewis Carroll. But this is read by Benedict Cumberbatch. There was lots of ones read. I picked him because that's what I picked. So, I need to talk about it from the beach. All right, here we go.
"'Twas brillig, and the slidy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch." He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the manxome foe he sought, so rested he by the Tumtum tree, and stood awhile in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock, with eyes of flame, came whiffling through the tuggly wood, and burbled as it came, one, two, and through, the vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy, O frabjous day, Callooh, Callay, he chortled in his joy. Twas Brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves and the mome raths outgrabe.
Excellent. I just can't now. I mean, I've seen so many versions of Alice in Wonderland, so many versions and shows and things over the years, and, of course, the books. But I have to tell you, I cannot read Oh, Frabjous Day, Callooh, Callay, without seeing the Alice in Wonderland, without seeing Johnny Depp dance. I can't unsee Johnny Depp as the Mad Hatter doing that chant. I don't know why. I just can't. So, of course, I mean, a lot of people, this is a very well-known poem. And, of course, the Jabberwocky. I feel like there could be a whole show about the Jabberwocky in itself. And I just love his poetry. I really do love his poetry. And his affinity to just kind of making up words like the Bandersnatch and the Jabberwocky. I mean, when you look at these things and then the Snickersnack, like I don't have anything to rhyme with back. So I'm going to say the Vorpal Blade went Snickersnack. I mean, that's just so fun. So, so fun. And I think I'd have to say this is one of my favorite, even though it's a very popular one. I'm not saying even though, but it's popular for a reason, but it is one of my favorites. I really wanted to put up the Hunting for a Snark, but it was the Hunting for a Snark is for like a half an hour. I'm going to have to do something like that's on its own show or something, you know, do a little tribute to that. But I was like, I can't do that one. It's too long. But I really do love Hunting for a Snark as well. Raconteur, any thoughts on this one?
You mentioned the snark. There's a famous I don't know fantasy that they call it a snipe hunt, and that's a popular story that they tell around the campfire, things like that, and it's I think a tradition, you know, kind of to tell that story. But you know, the making up of words, Jabberwocky, I think, found its way into computer terminology, and I don't know where. I mean, I recognize Bandersnatch too. I don't necessarily know from Alice in Wonderland, but you know, I think somebody even borrowed that word. But you know, they're catchy, and you know, the same way you could see Johnny Depp dance, it's the same kind of things imprint themselves on me. In the voice that I hear them in, like if I'm watching a cartoon or something from my youth, the things that were said, when I hear the phrase, I still hear it in the original, you know, the character's voice, you know, I mean, What's Up Doc is probably the best example because you can't not hear Bugs Bunny saying that. You almost have to want to, you know, when you say it, because that he doesn't just say, what's up, Doc? He does that, what's up, Doc? You know, so you got it's one of those things that just when it's presented in the way that it is, it's so memorable and almost addictive, like marketing. There's something psychological about it, I think, that just makes us our minds embrace it and want to hang on to it, whether it's the alliteration or you know, there's something about it that makes it so appealing. And it's definitely a beautiful example of that, you know. As much as he's making it up, it's like you could convince someone that doesn't know that, oh, no, there really are Bandersnatches. You know, they're laying right next to the crocodiles with the hooves.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, so 1870s, the earliest known use of the noun Bandersnatch. OED's earliest evidence for Bandersnatch is from 1871 in the writing of Lewis Carroll, author, mathematician, and photographer, real life name Charles Ludwig Dodgson. So, I mean, it is. So, like you said, though, people make up words and then they become common and they change and then they morph. I mean, that's what words, how every word is made up, you know? And that's the great thing about authors. You could just make up words. And then one day they might be in the Oxford English Dictionary. You know?
So, they get adopted, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so
you should
have
an adopt a word day.
Adopt a word day. I'm going to adopt this word. I mean, it's writer's privilege. I mean, you can just do whatever you want, really. That's the great thing about it. There's no rules. You just make up your own words, your own terms.
That'd make a great game. You know, you have a list of, like, very little used words in the English language and the definitions, and somebody, you know, you get to make up a word, and the other people have to guess if it's your made-up word or if it's a real word from the dictionary.
Sweet, I like that. She's doing, and like, I don't know if it was she just did one show or if she plans on doing another show, but she did a show on out-of-date words, and some of the words I actually, like, I know and I've used because I think they're just more, I mean, it's just if you, instead of saying a day after tomorrow, overmorrow, like, I just feel like that's more efficient.
Uh-huh. Someone famous had that expression about writing, and I think it might have been Thomas Jefferson, why use two words when one will suffice?
Yeah, exactly. So that might be something, too, that Sweet Pea might be interested in. All right. What did I do? Two poems? I think I did two poems, right? Yeah. So we'll go on to the second clip that I have for the second prompt. And that was Gigantic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which I think is just hilarious. Again, this is brought to you by PBS, public broadcasting. I just love PBS. Yeah, well, I just said public broadcasting. I just love them. All right, here we go. So, are you ready for some giant hamsters?
Oh, it depends on how you prepare them.
Oh my God, you want to eat them? All right, let's see how this is.
Greek and Roman mythology is full of stories about exotic islands that were home to weird and fearsome monsters, like one-eyed ogres, seductive sirens, and man-eating giants. And I'm here to tell you, back in the late Miocene epoch, there was in fact an island, or maybe a group of islands, in the Mediterranean Sea that was populated with fantastic giant beasts. But these giants were actually pretty small. Some of them you might even consider cute. There were enormous hamsters and big fat water birds that could neither fly nor swim, and hedgehog-like animals that were as big as house cats. These organisms were only giants compared to their ancestors, which had lived on the European mainland. But once they became isolated on these Mediterranean islands, some of these little critters attained massive body sizes. That's because geographic isolation is a powerful force in evolution. Sometimes, when a population of animals gets cut off from many of its normal predators or competitors, it gives rise to new species of unusual sizes. Sometimes they turn out to be miniaturized versions of their ancestors, other times giants. The tale of these Mediterranean island beasts of the Miocene is no myth. It's a lesson in the very strange but very real powers of natural selection. In 1969, a group of Dutch paleontologists were working in Gargano, a region on the eastern coast of Italy, when they discovered deep fissures or cracks in the limestone quarries and road cuts there. And these cracks turned out to be full of fossils. For millions of years, it seemed animals had been stumbling into these fissures like natural traps, starting about 8 million years ago. The result was an amazingly rich fossil deposit, a snapshot of life in this place in the late Miocene epoch. But a few things about the Gargano fossils turned out to be really odd. For one thing, scientists were confused about the fossils they didn't find. Elsewhere in Europe, deposits from the late Miocene tend to contain a lot of large mammals, like extinct elephants, cats, and perissodactyls, a group of hoofed animals that include horses. But at Gargano, none of those animals were anywhere to be found. Instead, researchers uncovered an eclectic and bizarre bestiary, including fossils of smaller animals that seemed overgrown. There were extra-large owls, alarmingly big hamsters, and supersized hedgehogs. This strange assortment of animals came to be known as the Microtia fauna. And for decades, the Gargano Peninsula, along with a handful of nearby towns, were the only places on the planet where these creatures were known. Then in the 1990s, fossils of some of those same peculiar animals turned up at Miocene sites near Scontroni, a town in central Italy. So what exactly were these animals? Why were the Miocene animals of Gargano and Scontroni so different from their counterparts in the rest of Europe? For paleontologists, the most likely explanation was that these areas must have been cut off, geographically separated from the rest of Europe. Specifically, they were probably islands, or maybe parts of the same island. This would explain not only why these animals appeared just at those sites, it would also account for the strange body sizes of animals that were ordinarily quite small. I've talked before about how in island environments, large body animals can often get smaller over time. For example, in the case of Colombian mammoths on the Channel Islands of California, the absence of large predators combined with limited food led natural selection to favor smaller body sizes. So after thousands of years, some of the giant Colombian mammoths had developed into what scientists consider a new, separate, and smaller species, the pygmy mammoth. This phenomenon is known as insular dwarfism, but it's only part of the story about how island environments can tinker with animals' body plans. The flip side is what happened to some of the animals on Gargano and Scontroni, insular gigantism. Both processes are part of what's known as Foster's Rule, identified by biologist J. Bristol Foster in 1964. Essentially, Foster's Rule says that in isolated environments, large animals frequently get smaller, and tiny animals often become larger. And this is what happened to many animals in the Microtia fauna, and it happened because their habitat allowed it to happen. Much like the modern Channel Islands, the regions of Gargano and Scontroni in the deep past were higher in elevation than the surrounding areas. So as sea levels rose and fell over millions of years due to changes in climate, these places became isolated from the rest of Europe and then reconnected many times. And it may have been during one of these periods of low sea levels when some ancestors of the island giants first made their way to Gargano and Scontroni. Researchers think that about 30 million years ago in the Oligocene epoch, a global cooling trend lowered sea levels in the Mediterranean and elsewhere, forming a land bridge between the mainland and these two spots. But then, about 15 million years ago, the climate warmed again and sea levels rose, turning those high spots into islands and severing their connection to the mainland. So maybe the ancestors of the Microtia fauna simply walked across the land bridge before it became submerged. But other scientists have proposed that most of them arrived much more recently, just around 8 million years ago, when the island or islands were properly isolated. In that case, it's thought that the animals might have rafted on piles of floating debris, like logs, branches, and palm leaves, much in the same way that the ancestors of South America's rodents are thought to have migrated from Africa. Either way, once they reached their new island habitats, many of these animals started to follow different evolutionary paths. Some stayed small, and some may have actually shrunk, but others responded to their new environments by getting downright huge. Just look at Dinogalarix, a shrew-like member of the hedgehog family that's found only in these Microtia fossil deposits. Early species of this genus were about 30 to 45 centimeters long, making them only slightly bigger than a modern European hedgehog. But over time, bigger and badder Dinogalarix started to evolve alongside them. The largest species, found only in the most recent deposits, was some 60 centimeters long. And even though it was a member of the hedgehog family, Dinogalarix had teeth that were more like those of cats and dogs. Using its long, pointy incisors and crushing cheek teeth, the largest of this genus probably behaved like a badger or raccoon, hunting much larger prey than its ancestors ever could. And it did, simply because it could. Back on the mainland, the ancestors of Dinogalarix needed to stay small in order to avoid all of the large predators. But in this island environment, there were very few large terrestrial carnivores. So without the selective pressure to remain small, Dinogalarix was free to expand in size and take advantage of new niches. Its ancestors probably specialized in eating insects, but this animal could have hunted other larger prey, like vertebrates. In the process, it emerged as one of the area's biggest land-dwelling hunters. This was Foster's rule in action. But a big old hedgehog-like thing still had some competitors and natural enemies, because these islands were also home to some unusually large birds of prey. Take the giant owl known as Taito Gigantea, which appeared on Gargano in the late Miocene. We don't know for sure which species it evolved from, but we do know that there was nothing near its size on the mainland. Based on its fossils, scientists think that Taito Gigantea may have had a wingspan of 2 meters or more, twice the size of a living barn owl. Likewise, the islands were also home to a bird of prey known as Gargano aetis, which included two species. The larger one probably rivaled today's golden eagle in size, and it's only found in more recent deposits. So this suggests that Gargano aetis, like the giant owl, developed a bigger body size over time. But here's a question. On an island with few other predators, why would these birds of prey get so large? Wouldn't it just mean that they needed to eat more food? Well, some researchers think that on these islands of giants, both predators and prey were engaged in a sort of evolutionary arms race. Research has shown that the modern barn owl can't swallow any rodents whose heads are larger than 17 millimeters. But by being bigger, these birds would have had an easier time hunting and gulping down the local rodents, which were also getting quite hefty. For example, there's the burrowing rodent Macrotia, the Gargano native that gave this whole group its name. One species of Macrotia had a skull that was twice the size of a modern rat's head, suggesting the rest of the animal was pretty big too. There was also a giant species of dormouse, which are usually tiny and adorable, but this one weighed about a kilogram, which, you know, still sounds pretty cute to me. And then there was Gargano's strange giant hamster, Hatomys gargantua. It was 3 times heavier than today's common hamster and much bigger than any species that lived on the mainland at this time. Mind you, not all of these island animals expanded in size over time. Small and normal-sized birds and rodents coexisted with giant species. But some rodents definitely got bigger, either because they simply could or because it let them expand into new dietary niches. And as they grew, the birds of prey also evolved larger sizes in order to hunt and eat them. This same phenomenon occurred among other kinds of birds too. Take the case of Gargonornis, first reported in 2013. Gargonornis belonged to the same family of birds as ducks and geese, but it weighed between 15 and 22 kilograms, up to twice as much as a large Canada goose. Unlike modern geese and ducks, its toes and lower leg bones were really short, suggesting that it spent most of its time walking on land and not paddling in the water. And judging by its bones and its wings, it probably couldn't fly either. So researchers think that Gargonornis adapted to take advantage of its island's lack of big herbivorous mammals. By growing bigger and staying on land, it may have been able to broaden its niche and forage on a wider range of terrestrial plants, while its size could have helped it fend off some of those birds of prey. And size adaptations seem to have benefited some larger mammals on the island too. One herbivore known exclusively from Macrotia deposits was the truly strange Hoplitomyrix, a genus of hoofed mammal with saber-like fangs and 5 horns on their head. 5! And there were lots of different species of this so-called prong deer that varied a lot in size. By one estimate, the smallest only weighed around 5 to 6 kilograms, while the biggest may have tipped the scales at 113 kilograms. And species of different sizes seem to have lived at the same time, which kind of makes sense. Different sizes would make different food sources available to each species. This would have not only kept the prong deer from competing with each other, it could have also prevented them from overgrazing their little island. But there was a change on the horizon that none of the weird and beautiful Macrotia fauna could adapt their way out of. About 5.3 million years ago, a massive amount of Atlantic water passed through the Strait of Gibraltar, which had once been lifted above sea level. This flooded the Mediterranean. Rising water levels dramatically shrank the little giant's island habitat, which is probably what drove them to extinction. Just a few million years later in the early Pleistocene, some areas of central and southern Italy went through a period of tectonic uplift. That reunited Gargano and Scontroni with the rest of the mainland where they remain today. So competition, food availability, predator-prey relationships, and niche expansion, any or all of these things can very gradually make either pygmies or giants out of animals that are isolated on islands. It's not mythology, it's natural history, and we have their fascinating fossil remains to remind us of the odd little giants that once roamed these ancient Mediterranean islands.
Awesome. I love that they mention the stories, you know, of these ancient stories where they have these myths and things and how much could have come from, I mean, we take from real life now and we create fantasy and how much it would be to see. It would be cool to see how much historical writing is influenced by creatures as well that we may not know or that have gone extinct, and I don't know.
The idea of like giant birds and things like that isn't so far fetched. I mean, we've got ostriches. You know, it's like, you know, well, they don't fly. They've got big feet, but they're still birds, and you know, so it feels the same kind of science in action. So we're watching, you know, as these things happen. You had the down the tubes with that island of lizards that were all female, if you remember that one. I don't remember what they were called, but there was that was one of your, you know, things too, evolution and you know, being cut off and natural, whatever.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And, like, we haven't gotten to the dodo bird yet, but same thing. Like, that wasn't even that long ago, the dodo bird. And when it was around, nobody paid attention to it because they were like, this is a useless bird. And then one day it was gone. And then it was so obscure that not a lot of people have it in a recording, you know, recorded down, just in some stories. But it really wasn't that long ago. But we will get there. I'm jumping ahead.
Yes.
I like the idea of the giant owls. That would be kind of scary. but in Rack's world, we related. they mentioned mice, so I have a mouse's tail. They mentioned big birds, but I have a poem about little birds. And they were talking about an island. And the walrus and the carpenter is by the sea, so it's all relatable.
Absolutely.
In Rack and Tour's world. So I'm going to read A Mouse's Tale because there's no recording, and I'm going to read it. And if I have to stop midway, I apologize. So this is The Mouse's Tale by Lewis Carroll. Fury said to the mouse that he met in the house, let us both go to law. I will prosecute you. Come, I'll take no denial. We must have a trial. For really this morning, I've nothing to do, said the mouse to the cur. Such a trial, dear sir, with no jury or judge, would be wasting our breath. I'll be judge, said the cunning old fury. I'll try the whole cause and condemn you to death. End poem. It's a little dark. I don't think giving over the ability to judge with someone you're having an argument with is a good idea. That's just my opinion. death is a little harsh. I don't know. I thought that was really fun. And the way that it's written, it's just, I don't know, it's just cute and fun and a little dark. What do you think?
I think, you know, a mouse couldn't be a lawyer, but a rat certainly could.
No, you're good. I don't know why I didn't see that coming. all right, so we have... All right, we have, what did I say? The
the extinct bird.
The little bird. I know. I'm trying to find it. I got to refresh because I took some out. Okay, a little bird. See, I usually put them in 1, 2, 3, like how I'm going to play them.
Yes.
And I didn't do that this time. I just put them in as is. So now I don't have my whole little 1, 2, 3 to fall back on. All right, Little Birds. And this is read by Jordan Harling. Here we go.
Little birds are dining, warily and well, hid in a mossy cell. Hid, I say, by waiters, gorgeous in their gaiters. I've a tale to tell. Little birds are feeding, justices with jam, rich in frizzled ham, rich, I say, in oysters, haunting shady cloisters. That is what I am. Little birds are teaching tigresses to smile, innocent of guile. Smile, I say, not smirkle. Mouth a semicircle, that's their proper style. Little birds are sleeping, all among the pins, where the loser wins, where, I say, he sneezes, when and how he pleases, so the tale begins. Little birds are writing interesting books, to be read by cooks, read, I say, not roasted, letterpress when toasted, loses his good looks. Little birds are playing, bagpipes on the shore, where the tourists snore. Thanks, they cry, 'tis thrilling, take, oh, take a shilling, let us have no more. Little birds are bathing, crocodiles in cream, like a happy dream, like, but not so lasting. Crocodiles, when fasting, are not all they seem. Little birds are choking, baronets with bun, taught to fire a gun, taught, I say, to splinter. Salmon in the winter, merely for the fun. Little birds are hiding, crimes in carpet bags, blessed by happy stags. Blessed, I say, though beaten, since our friends are eaten, when their memory flags. Little birds are tasting gratitude and gold, pale with sudden cold, pale, I say, and wrinkled, when the bells have tinkled, and the tale is told.
I heard you laughing pretty much to that whole poem. Do you want the first comment?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to make a sandwich. I was making a food joke.
Oh, my goodness. I need to use the word smirkle in a poem. I didn't even know that was like a conjugal of smirk. I'm like, I don't even understand. But you kind of, okay, what am I going to rhyme with semicircle? Oh, it's fine. I'll just say smirkle. Like, who does that? that's what I take away from this is smirkle. I know there was so much stuff happening in here. He must really like oysters. He brings oysters a lot in his poems. He must really enjoy them. But this is fun. I loved this. This is so clever. So clever, of course. And I don't always like when poems repeat. But when done well, it does have a rhythm to it. And I do think it was done well here, obviously. And I like the bagpipes. And just the way that there was another one too, crocodiles and cream, which I really, I don't know why, I just really enjoyed that one. And then crocodiles when fasting are not all they seem. I just really, I enjoy that as well. And then there was, towards the end, when the bells have tinkled. So that he can rhyme with wrinkled. It's just so fun to be able to cut loose and write something funny, clever, and just have fun with the rhyme. And everybody's kind of afraid of, not everybody, but some people are afraid of rhyme. They're like, I don't want to rhyme. I don't want to do that. My problem is that sometimes I want to rhyme and sometimes I don't. And if I'm in the middle of a poem, if I want to stop rhyming, I'll just say, okay, I'm not rhyming anymore. And that's it. But some people say, oh, if you're going to rhyme, rhyme all the way. If you're not going to rhyme, don't rhyme at all. And I'm kind of like, I'm going to do what I want because I'm going to write what I want. But this is such a fun way to keep the rhyme going and just kind of just being carefree. And I could just see him writing this poem with a smirk on his face. I would imagine the whole time, like, I don't know. I just really do. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Like you say, it was a lot of fun. And, he had a bit of a food theme going and, you know, the little birds and, you know, not being eaten and then the crocodile and not being seen. And the whole progression of it was, you know, it was interrelated. So it was, you know, it bounced. It was very lighthearted and memorable, you know, smirkle. Yeah, that word's going to stick too.
No, I'm just going to start saying that. Don't get that little smirkle off your face. And people, it's so uncommon to hear that. They're going to be like, what? That's not right. And you're like, actually, it is. Also, this little birds are feeding justices with jam. I just love it. Yeah.
That the mouse was holding court, so they were feeding the justices with jam.
Yeah, I mean, this is two poems with a mice in the legal system. I think something's happening here. There's a... get that smirkle off your face. Someone was just talking about, we were talking about mouse books, like Mouse and the Motorcycle and
other ones.
That's the one I remember. I love that series. But there was another one and now it all comes together today with this poem. And Little Mouse. All right, we've got, as I said, as I promised, we've got the Walrus and the Carpenter. And, oh, I was supposed to refresh my page so that I can have less to look at, and I totally forgot to do that. I really enjoy the Walrus and the Carpenter. That was one of my favorite. Like, when I watched the film, I definitely watched the film before I read the book. And I remember, I don't know why, maybe it was just like half sun, half moon, or because it was such a, maybe I had an affinity for sad tales even then. like a little old me was like, oh, well, this is really sad and I like it. But I really enjoyed that part. All right, so... The Walrus and the Carpenter. Here we go.
The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright, and this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be. The sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead. There were no birds to fly. The Walrus and the Carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If seven maids with seven mops swept it for half a year, do you suppose, the Walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the Carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. O oysters, come and walk with us, the Walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk, along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than four to give a hand to each. The eldest oyster looked at him, and never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But four young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat. And this was odd, because, you know, they hadn't any feet. Four other oysters followed them, and yet another four, and thick and fast they came at last, and more and more and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock conveniently low, and all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. "The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings. But wait a bit," the oysters cried, "before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath and all of us are fat." "No hurry," said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. "A loaf of bread," the walrus said, "is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar besides are very good indeed. Now, if you're ready, oysters dear, we can begin to feed." "But not on us," the oysters cried, turning a little blue. "After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do." "The night is fine," the walrus said. "Do you admire the view?" "It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice." The carpenter said nothing but, "Cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice." "Seems a shame," the walrus said, "to play them such a trick, after we've brought them out so far and make them trot so quick." The carpenter said nothing but, "The butter's spread too thick." "I weep for you," the walrus said. "I deeply sympathize." With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. "Oh, oysters," said the carpenter, "you had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again?" But answer came there none, and this was scarcely odd, because they'd eaten everyone.
Awesome. And of course, if you're like, "I know that voice, what is that voice?" It's Sir Arthur John Gielgud. And yeah, he did a lot of theater. And if you don't know who he is, look him up. I mean, he's also done films. I had just, we just actually celebrated one of those miniseries, rather, maybe a couple months ago on Storyboards, because he was in Merlin. We've done Dragonheart here at Storyboards, and he was King Arthur's voice. I mean, he was also in The First Knight as Oswald, and that was, we also did on Storyboards, his acting career spans amazing. So I'm just naming a couple more probably popular ones that are newer that we've actually done here at Storyboard. We haven't done Quest for Camelot yet, but yeah, I think his newest was Elizabeth the Pope, so he played the Pope. But yeah, I love that one. Like I said, I don't know, I think it's because of the irony and of just, I don't know what it is. I think maybe because I seen the film when I was young, and it may have been because they actually do this poem on Alice in Wonderland. Maybe it was my first introduction to poetry, watching Alice in Wonderland, maybe. I don't know if I've watched, if I watched any other films that had poetry in it, but I can remember that young. You know, when you start watching those films, you're just a kid. But I loved it, and I wanted to share it with you guys. What do you think? You love that one.
Again, hungry, because, you know, he brought us oysters now. And I kept wanting him to make a pun about them clamming up, but no, you know, and however silent they were, it wasn't because they clammed up. So that was all in my own head.
I got a smirk
on
my face.
Hatter.
Hey. Snuck in the back.
You can't unmute yourself. What are you doing? Hi, Hatter. I love that. Were you listening about what we were talking about, smirkling?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was.
What do you think? Do you love do you like the smirkle, or do you like the
That's a good word. Use it as a defense, Your Honor. You got a smirkle.
Oh my gosh. Now we just listened to The Walrus and the Carpenter.
I missed that.
It was just playing. It was just, because you were calling in. So you were probably on hold, and that's too bad. It was really, really good. I mean, you know The Walrus and the Carpenter, obviously, right? Yeah.
You ask who does that, making up words? Who does that?
I do that. I love it.
No,
that was saying. That's what Hatter was thinking.
To
like, I'm going to call her and tell her who she thinks she is talking about herself.
Yeah.
But that's what I love about it. Like, Roald Dahl, he just makes shit up, and then it goes in the dictionary. Like, I just love it. You know, I admire it. I think it's just wonderful. So we are going down the tube ladder, and I have three prompts. We have already talked about the island in the Mediterranean where they had they had gigantic beasts and where to find them. Of course, a play on Harry Potter. And they were like giant owls and giant rodents, and it was awesome. And then we also talked
true? That's true?
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the thick on
so
the fossils,
They found the fossils. So we played that one already. I mean, you could always look at the videos later if you want, or just listen to the playback, and you'll be able to hear it, listen to the whole playback. And then we also talked about the croc, that giant croc that ran on hooves. So he got it. I'm trying to imagine this. And the only one we haven't played yet, which I'm waiting, is the dodo bird. And because this show featured the dodo bird, and because when I first saw it or introduced to the dodo bird, it was in Alice in Wonderland. Because of that and because of the crocodiles and the mice, I had put together an assembly of Lewis Carroll poems. So I featured some of them. I still have a couple more left. But you can find a poem on any of those topics. Anything really is relatable here at Down the Tube. Anything is really relatable. So find me a poem and put it on the top of the board, and we'll get it up there.
To Charles Dodson? I mean, Lewis Carroll?
Yeah, no, to anything. To any of the topics or what I just said. Like, literally, you can, if you put a poem up, Rack can probably make it relatable. I just picked Lewis Carroll because he had poems that were I thought were relatable, and because he's the reason why I love dodo birds. So
fidgety,
I thought
quirky.
It was
they
perfect.
Were fidgety quirky. Fidgety quirky.
Yes, we haven't got we haven't gotten to that clip yet too, so you're just in time for that clip.
Oh,
we're not there. We might be there yet. I do want to. It's 9:14. I'm going to play the clip of the dodo bird. I'm going to get the folders together so I can plug shows after, but I want to make sure I have them all in order. So here's the clip of the dodo bird. And Hatter, you look for a poem, but you got to listen too because you'll miss the dodo bird. But here we go. And it's brought to you by PBS.
You might think that you know the story of the dodo, that fat, flightless bird that once roamed the mountainous tropical forests of the island of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. It's long been a poster child for extinction and an example of an evolutionary mistake, a species whose eventual demise at the hands of humans was pretty much inevitable. Even the dodo's name is rumored to have come from a Portuguese word for a simpleton. I've been called worse. But it turns out that the things you might have heard about the dodo are just not true. And this is partially because when it went extinct, nobody actually noticed. No one was really worried about preserving any information about it until it was too late. It would take a new discovery in 2005 for us to realize that almost all of our old assumptions about it were just totally wrong. It turns out we didn't know the dodo at all. So what is the real story of the dodo? How did such a unique bird even evolve in the first place? And are we really responsible for its extinction? Well, much like the dodo itself, the answers to these questions are not so simple. As far as we can tell, people never spent much time on Mauritius until the early 16th century, when sailors began stopping there on their travels. The first written records of the dodo date to 1598. Dutch sailors described it as fat, slow, and so oblivious to threats that it could be caught and killed easily. And even though they apparently weren't especially tasty, a single chonky dodo could feed so many sailors that they were hunted in large numbers. 60 years later, the dodo was gone. The last widely accepted sighting dates to around 1660, but no one is really sure exactly when it disappeared because no one was really paying attention. In fact, the concept of an entire species being gone forever hadn't really caught on in Western science yet. Extinction wouldn't even be proposed until around a century later in the late 1700s. So it wasn't until well after the dodo had already vanished that scientists started paying attention. See, when the British took over Mauritius in 1810, a major boom in interest in natural history was unfolding. And by that point, tales of the dodo were so odd that at first British naturalists wondered if it ever had been real at all, likening it to a mythical phoenix. In 1816, they held a meeting to ask the island's oldest inhabitants if they remember the dodo or any talk of it. Now, over 150 years had passed since the last known sighting, so unsurprisingly, they did not. All that was left were some Dutch illustrations and stories, many of which contradicted each other, as well as a few bones and body parts scattered in museums throughout Europe. The world had been left without even one complete dodo. In 1848, two naturalists working at Oxford published their first scientific work on the animal. They'd used the little evidence they'd been able to gather and study and drew from the various Dutch accounts from centuries earlier. They called it a strange, abnormal bird with a grotesque appearance, which seems needlessly mean, but they were at least convinced that it had once existed. They concluded that it was some odd form of pigeon, an idea that they were widely ridiculed for at the time. And for a long time, that's about as complete a picture of the rise and fall of the dodo as we had. But in 2005, all that began to change. Excavations at a swamp on the island unearthed more than 200 dodo bones, giving researchers a chance to study the animal in a new light. The site allowed them to understand the broader ecosystem of the dodo and put the species into its actual ecological context for the first time. And what the researchers found was surprising. The dodo's supposed stupidity wasn't a result of having evolved in a sheltered paradise that left them fat, happy, and complacent. The swamp and the dodos it preserved told a totally different story. What the researchers saw was an ecosystem characterized by significant environmental challenges. Climatic instability and extreme weather events like cyclones and droughts were common. For example, the site documented a drought 4,200 years ago that caused animals to flock to the area in search of fresh water. The stress of this event even left a mark in the bones of the dodos themselves. These marks came in the form of lines of arrested growth, which reveal periods where growth slowed as the animal struggled to find resources. So the fact that dodos, as a species, were able to survive and thrive under these kinds of repeated challenges over evolutionary time meant that they must have actually been pretty resilient and well adapted to their unpredictable home. And the more complete skeletons from this swampy bone bed even revealed that the birds had a number of impressive adaptations for their environment. For example, they had strong legs, which would have helped them get around in their mountainous environment. And they had big skulls that housed a pretty large brain with well-developed olfactory regions, suggesting they had a good sense of smell. Plus, as the field of ancient DNA has advanced over the last two decades, we've even been able to study dodo genetics in increasing detail. This has revealed that dodos are indeed most closely related to doves and pigeons, confirming the idea proposed by Oxford researchers back in 1848. Okay, but so how do they end up becoming so unusual compared to their closest living relatives? Well, it seems that dodos emerged from a flying Asian pigeon ancestor that began crossing the Indian Ocean around 43 million years ago. As a chain of volcanic islands began to form in the ocean around this time, the birds used them as stepping stones on their travels. Eventually, when Mauritius emerged from the waves around 7 million years ago, the dodo's ancestors arrived by air, settled into their new home, and became flightless. After all, evolution is about trade-offs. And in an environment without any predators, the ability to fly simply wasn't worth the energy cost. It's a process we've seen happen time and time again with birds that arrive on islands without animals they need to evade. Flight becomes unnecessary, wings become vestigial, and bodies become bulky, sometimes comically so. Okay, so if the dodo was actually pretty well adapted to its environment rather than being an evolutionary mistake, then what happened to them? Like, why did they go extinct? Well, the classic story is that we simply ate them to extinction because they were too easy to catch. But in reality, it seems that this was less a result of our appetite and more our habit of altering the delicate balance of ecosystems wherever we go. You see, dodos had one key vulnerability that may have spelled their downfall, an Achilles heel, if you will, that put them at risk even before they were born. They only laid one large egg at a time, and on the ground too, rather than hidden away in some treetop nest. And when people arrived on Mauritius, we brought a couple of very egg-hungry associates with us. The associates I'm talking about are pigs and rats. These creatures have devastated a range of island bird species across the world after being introduced, regardless of whether those birds seemed intelligent or agile or not. So it wasn't exactly us humans that doomed the dodo, not directly, at least. Nor is it necessarily their supposed lack of smarts and speed. Far from being the hopeless sitting duck that it may have seemed at first glance, the dodo was, for the most part, an evolutionary success. It was a species superbly adapted to its specific ecological conditions. Until, of course, we and other mammals that we traveled with suddenly changed those conditions. And its demise didn't just prove to be a valuable case study in understanding the concept of extinction, back when that was a radical new idea, but it also may end up being a case study in an equally radical idea emerging today. De-extinction. Armed with our new understanding of the dodo's ecology, its DNA, and the recognition that its extinction was not inevitable, the possibility of bringing it back is seriously being explored. So perhaps the dodo's story has another surprising chapter or two just waiting to be written.
I see a lot of those. Things. You know, I don't want to get into the politics of whether it's right or wrong, but I've been seeing a lot of those. Are we going to bring this back? Are we going to bring that back? It's interesting. I don't know how I land on it, and I don't want to have a discussion on it, really, because I think some people might get a little heated. Not us three, obviously. I know we can handle a conversation, but, you know. But yeah, I think a lot of people know the dodo bird, but I don't think they really know the history of it. And I didn't really know the history of it either until I stumbled upon that video. And I just absolutely love learning random things if you hadn't, you know, gotten that impression yet. So, all right. Thoughts, comments, back and forth?
Wow.
What did he say was the reason they went extinct?
Well, they came in with wings, and then they settled into an area that there really were no natural predators. So they, you know, that they lost the ability to fly over time. And then humans came in with other animals like rats and pigs that ate their eggs. So they only really hatched, you know, one egg, one large egg on the ground. They really weren't up high or safe. So they didn't reproduce fast enough, and they went extinct. So, I mean, it says humans weren't directly at fault, but, I mean, if you're bringing over rats and pigs into an area that didn't really have those, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, I would say, yeah, they are. I would say that is. Plus, I mean, they were being eaten too. So if they're being eaten and they're not reproducing fast enough, and then the offspring that they're trying to reproduce is also being eaten by various rodents and or pigs, then they're going to drop. Their numbers are going to drop, unfortunately, to nothing.
Sounds like they did it to themselves.
So, by not putting their eggs up high. And
yeah, I mean, you know, there's a road coming through. No, of course, we push them to different habitats, which wasn't friendly. So, yeah, you ruin everything.
Yeah. Did you find me a poem?
I am stuttering.
Okay, so you have not found one yet, right?
Not yet.
I'll
let you know.
Okay. So I'm gonna you let me know. I'm going to plug. So the next show maybe I'm not gonna plug right now. Okay, the next show, I don't have these in the right order. All right, the next show is my show because I'm going to be on tomorrow, and it's going to be storyboards. And I'm really excited about this one. And this is one show that I've wanted to do for a while. And sometimes when I really love something, I tend to wait because I'm like, I'm not ready yet. There's a couple of these that I've been waiting for years to do on storyboards, and I finally said, you know what, I'm going to do it. Two of them are going to be this month, and then the other one's going to be next year because I just can't do it. I can't do it yet. So tomorrow is going to be Swan Lake, the 1981 version. It was a Japanese version, and they had, like, English subtitles and voiceover dubs. And I remember seeing this when I was younger, and I don't know how old I was, but I was very, very young. And I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that this is where my love for classical music came from. Because, of course, they've featured Swan Lake by Tchaikovsky in this film. And I remember being completely moved by the film, but by the music more that was carried through the film. And, when I was younger, I'd never seen, like, I was young, so it's not like I'm going to see, you know, ballets or anything like that. But this is definitely the reason why I love classical music and why today, if anybody says, what's your favorite song, hands down, I say Swan Lake. It's my favorite song ever made, period. In any genre, it is my favorite. I just love it. That's my favorite. So you could write to any of the characters and or quotes. Quotes, you can go anywhere you want, even if off topic. So if you click one of their names, it'll send you to a site that has, like, their quotes on them. And even if it's not related to the film, as long as it's related to the quote, you're fine. Bring the poem. So if you have a pre-written poem you want to share, find a quote and go with it. But also, you could write to the themes. There is a love story in here. So if you want to bring me a love poem, you bring me a love poem. So really, it's how you want to relate it to the topic. I do have clips from the film, which is hard to find, but it is on YouTube. The quality is pretty low. It's a pretty rare find, this film, this version. There's, like, a newer version, but I just, this is my favorite version. And I do have, obviously, we're going to be enjoying the Swan Lake Suite. So I'm really excited about it. That is tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Storyboards. And the next show is Sweet, but I'm not sure. There's no topic, so I'm not sure what she's doing. But she's usually on Thursday at 10. And I just don't see a topic here right now. She'll probably have one up. But on Friday, we have Liquid Damage, and she is doing open poetry. She's on Friday at 10 Eastern Standard Time. So stop by and say hello. Bring any poem you want. And then, of course, Saturday, do you want to plug that one, Hatter? It's
Saturday,
Fathers
yeah,
and Dads.
Yeah, Fathers and Dads. Dads.
All right, and that is Saturday at... Do you go live at 9? I feel like you've been going live at 9.
Yes, it's been at 9. But that subject could change once a week, so you just check it. It would be 9 or 10, usually.
Okay, so keep an eye out. And then Monday, picture prompt Monday, if Deb is listening, Deb, I did secure a photo from your show yesterday, but I had to go to sleep and I could not write. I'm still not 100%. But I did take a photo from you yesterday, and I might reserve one from you next week. Well, I know I'm going to. But she has beautiful fall colors for Photo Prompt Monday. Each person gets their own prompt. I'm really loving this butterfly one. She's in a butterfly dress. I don't know. I got a cough. Take over explaining Monday for me for a second.
you did that whole series on the days of the week too, and where they come from.
I
and...
did. that's not plugging, Deb. You're so funny. Every Monday night, Deb has a picture prompt. She has a word bank. It is optional. You do not have to use it, but you can if you want to. They're really pretty. They're all out of her color crayon box. And one picture per poet.
Reserve your picture.
All colors. Reserve your picture, yes, thank you. If you haven't heard, Hatter, I'm still recovering, and I am prone to coughing.
Yeah. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling better. I'm feeling better, but I had to cancel last week my show. I rebooked it. I took out the shutter button poetry this month. There were no poems dropped anyway, but I did take that out and I just replaced it with storyboards, the one I had to cancel. But I'm recovering, but I am prone to coughing fits. So there's the lineup. And then after Deb, we go back to me on storyboards, and that's the makeup show, and we're doing The Mandalorian Season 3. So I'm just love The Mandalorian Season 3, and I just recently finished it, so it just came out not too long ago. But all right.
I was trying to write for the Dodo. I could read what I have. I just not finished.
How about you bring what you have in the Dodo, and then you bring just another poem that you want to share. How about that?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, let me reread this.
Right.
This is what I had for the Dodo. And it was a great – I thought it was a good idea, but I'll let you judge. Okay, hunting
Dodo. Do you
have
Dodo, a link? Hold on. Do you have a
no,
link for it?
No.
No, okay.
It's written down. It's
all right,
not,
I'll tell you.
It's not long. It's not long.
Okay. All right.
Okay. It goes like this. Hunting Dodo is not an easy task. First, it's hard to put on the mask. You cannot fly. Then why a bird? This seems strange and a little bit weird. It was once called a do. Just if asked, what would you do? The stutter word started by a man called Bobo. He tried, but all we could say was dodo. Dodo dee, dodo da da. Dooling down the dabble is just the east of Arkansas. Okay, that's it.
I feel like a little riddle coming on.
I know.
I thought you and Sweet would especially like this topic because she's a huge Alice in Wonderland fan, and of course they feature dodo birds. And you
yeah.
tend to really like rhyme and Kate, you know, a little bit, you know, obviously.
Yeah, what were you saying about rhyme that
twisted.
You just weren't going to do it? You said, so I just wasn't going to rhyme or... I was done with it.
Oh, no. I said some people – I said it was really fun with reading the Jabberwocky because he was so creative in his rhymes, and he's like, what am I going to rhyme with this? Oh, I'm just going to do this. And it was so creative. And then I was saying that some people have the notion, if you're going to rhyme, rhyme everything. And if not, then you need to go free verse, but don't mix the two. And I said, I don't agree with that. And sometimes I'll have a completely free verse poem, and then I'll end with a rhyming couplet. Or I'll have a poem and I'll rhyme, and then I'll go to free verse, and then I'll rhyme, and then I'll go to free verse, and then I'll rhyme. And some people are like, no, don't, you can't do that. And I just don't agree with it. Not that I don't have fully rhyming poems. I do, or fully free verse poems. And not to say that sometimes when I am in a rhyme, I do all I can to keep within that rhyme. But if I really don't feel it, and I'm like, no, I just really want to say this, and it's free verse, I don't push it. I just do what I think feels right, and do whatever I want.
One rhyme,
you know?
One rhyming line in any piece is the definition of a rhyming poem. That's actually cheap.
Yeah, well, some people are very like adamant about rhyme every line, or don't do it at all. And I just don't have that belief. People can have their own beliefs. You know, they can have that opinion. That's fine. I just don't agree with it. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, it's like there's no rules at all for free. I disagree with that. I mean, you can write a journal entry. You could write a grocery list and call it a poem. Or you could have some kind of unwritten structure that's easily read. It's not trip over anything. The cadence usually is important because to feed into one long descriptive line, you need one that's basically like it. So there are similarities, and I think as long as there's structure, some kind of structure, free. It's like I've always said, the long run-on sentence. Just don't stop. Just keep going. Is basically what I feel is a good recipe for free.
Yeah.
Little bird.
my goddaughter, she's young. She's under 10, and she's been writing. She obviously is around me a lot, and I read her a lot of poetry, and her favorite's Robert Frost, and so she loves stopping by the woods. I buy her like the children versions as well, so she has picture versions of these poems. And so she has a little book, and she calls it her book of poems, and she writes, and they're just thoughts. And she's like, it's not really poetry. I'm like, listen, it's a poem. If you say it's a poem, it's a poem. Anything can be a poem. And so she just has fun writing them, and you got to encourage that, you know. It's a poem. If you say it's a poem, it's a poem.
Yeah. Confuse it and call it a prose or your muse. It's your muse.
Yeah.
Is that how music started?
Maybe. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think you need to research that. All right, drop another poem, and then we need to Google. Let's Google that. I'm gonna play my next poem, Dreamland by Lewis Carroll, and someone's gotta research that where music, the word music originated from.
Okay.
All right, actually,
okay.
You know
I'm
what? Okay. Thanks, Hatter. All right, I'm going to play Dreamland. So, and this is read by Morphing Reality. And this is just a YouTuber, not just a YouTuber, but it's not the other ones that I had, like voice actors and more famous people. But he is actually a YouTuber, and he does a lot of poetry readings, and they're really good. So if you have a chance, go check out his site. And this is him reading Dreamland.
Dreamland by Lewis Carroll. When midnight mists are creeping and all the land is sleeping, around me tread the mighty dead and slowly pass away. Lo, warrior saints and sages from out the vanished ages, with solemn pace and reverent face appear and pass away. The blaze of noonday splendor, the twilight soft and tender may charm the eye, yet they shall die, and pass away. But here, in dreamland's center, no spoiler's hand may enter. These visions fair, this radiance rare, shall never pass away. I see the shadows falling, the forms of old recalling. Around me tread the mighty dead, and slowly pass away.
Pause for dramatic effect.
Yeah. So I picked that one. Rat, you're going to have to relate it because I just really liked that one, and I just picked, there was no relation to any of my jokes. I just thought, I'm sure you can relate it somehow. You're good at that.
Success. I found the answer.
Oh, okay. Where does music originate?
The origin of the word music. The word music comes from the Greek word musike, which means art of the muses. In ancient Greek, the muses included the goddesses of music, poetry, art, and dance. Someone who makes music is known as a musician. So, yeah, it's got all sorts of muses.
Yeah, so that's where it comes from, muses, yeah.
Absolutely.
I wonder if there's a Greek story. I really love the small Greek story, like a story around that. I love those little tidbits.
Yeah.
What did we just talk about? Right, the cypress tree, and why they say it has sap, and that's from a Greek mythology story. So there's so many of them that I just love. I love learning about. I really should probably bring those to some of my shows. Yeah, I have some really random stuff. But I don't...
Like the willow.
I would have to figure out if they have that on YouTube, or maybe I can just put it out there and say the information myself, because those stories, I don't learn them on YouTube. I've heard the stories and I've read the stories, so I don't know how that would work out, but I think that would be a good idea. Thanks, Hatter.
I'm looking. I'm looking to see if there was any other connection with the music as far as.
I mean, a lot
as,
of things have come from Greek mythology. I wouldn't. Or from Greece in general. I wouldn't doubt it. A lot of our words, stem and from Latin, like they're all rooted in that. So I won't doubt it.
Okay.
But another one. What was a poem I did the other day? It was about capricious, right? Capricious.
About
that was the sap one, but there's another one. What did I do? For chrysanthemums, chrysanthemums come from a Greek. From the Greek as well, so from a Greek god of flowers. So,
do you know why?
About it.
Do you know why they say we have music? And I don't buy this for a minute. And it might be the dry, unromantic definition, but they say the music acts as a healing therapy that helps in relieving stress and anxiety, and helps in refreshing the mood. It helps us bring positivity into our lives. See, now, I look at music as it's the gift from heaven. It's the gift from the gods.
I mean, I believe in all the things that music does. I do believe music is healing. I think that they're on levels. I mean, that's why I had said Swan Lake is my favorite. I mean, when I listen to that song... when it gets to a mid, you know, probably about three quarters through that song, and I'm emotionally just like just beside myself almost every time. If I'm not around anybody and I'm by myself and I'm closing my eyes and I'm just focusing on that song, I'm emotionally moved every time.
Okay.
Swan Lake. Every single time.
Oh,
every
true,
single time.
True.
If I'm not focused on anything else and I'm listening to it and I have my eyes closed, I will have tears. Like it is in my, just welling in my eyes. I wouldn't say like total tears, but just a little watery. You know, that song, it moves me every time, and I've listened to it my entire life. I just love that song. So I completely agree that music does move the soul. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. So. But the definition, I mean, the definition just sounds so dry and uneventful, you know. But, you know, that what's the group that does a cappella? Evanescence or something?
Well, Evanescence doesn't do a cappella. Evanescence is Amy Lee, but do you mean Pentatonic?
When they sing Hallelujah, when they sing I get the goosebumps up my arms and my hair stands up in the back of my neck. So probably the same thing as tearing up. See, I don't cry no more.
Yeah, they are really good, yeah. They were on tour with Lindsey Stirling, and I really wanted to see them. I wanted to take my godson with him. I knew he would have loved it. He loved them, too, as well, but I just couldn't swing it. But
did you know the band?
I want to get your other poem.
The band doesn't stay the same members, that their members come and go depending on what they're doing or where they're at. There are some members that seem to be
came in and out.
Yeah, a couple of them are starting. Yeah, well, great.
No matter what, they sound amazing. Don't be sorry. I love Pentatonic. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so I want you to find your poem. I have one more poem to feature, and that's You Are Old, Father William. And it's read by Tom O'Bedlam, and I love him. I love Tom O'Bedlam. Although I think the first poem that I heard him read on YouTube was The Ice Cream People by Charles Bukowski. Which is a very interesting poem. I love that poem. It's my favorite poem by him. One of my favorite poems. I think maybe I have one more, but I really love The Ice Cream People. I don't know why. I just really do. But every time I hear Tom and Bedlam, I just can't help but hear The Ice Cream People by Charles Bukowski. But I really love his voice. He's so good. But here you go. This is just a short poem, my last one of the evening. And then we have one we're going to close out with Hatter as well. And then I have a little bit of my music that I'm going to talk about for the closing song, which I think Rackentor is going to love. So here we go.
You Are Old, Father William by Lewis Carroll. You are old, Father William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white. And yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think, at your age, it is right? In my youth, Father William replied to his son, I feared it might injure the brain, but now that I'm perfectly sure I have none, why, I do it again and again. You're old, said the youth, as I mentioned before, and you have grown most uncommonly fat, yet you turned a back somersault in at the door. Pray, what is the reason for that? In my youth, said the sage, as he shook his grey locks, I kept all my limbs very supple, by the use of this ointment, 1 shilling a box. Allow me to sell you a couple. You are old, said the youth, and your jaws are too weak for anything tougher than suet. Yet you finish the goose with the bones and the beak. Pray, how did you manage to do it? In my youth, said his father, I took to the law and argued each case with my wife. And the muscular strength which it gave to my jaw has lasted the rest of my life. You are old, said the youth. One would hardly suppose that your eye was as steady as ever, yet you balanced an eel on the end of your nose. What made you so awfully clever? I have answered 3 questions, and that is enough, said his father. Don't give yourself airs. Do you think I can listen all day to such stuff? Be off, or I'll kick you downstairs.
No, I just picked that one because I love it. That's the only reason why. So I just thought, if I'm going to be having Lewis Carroll, I'm going to bring some fun poems. So that's it. That's my last Lewis Carroll poem. And then we've got, do you have a poem, Hatter?
Yep. Put this on the board now.
All right, you can put it. Yeah, just put it right on the board because I'm going to take my topic down.
Okay.
Make sure I have a copy of this topic.
I was trying to find the trilogy, Alice, but I couldn't run across it in time, so I found this one.
Yeah, I mean, really, any Alice poem would be relatable. I mean, that's the joy of how I run my shows. Anything's relatable.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's how I run it. So.
Okay. That's so in a book. Yeah. Do you have it? I put two up there, but this is the one I want to read.
It says so in a book.
Okay.
I have it.
So in a book, he says. Would you read it for me? I'm really struggling to see.
I can, but I want to let you know that I tried not to read today because I am having problems with it.
She's struggling to talk.
I am struggling to talk. That's why I had so many clips today, too, because I was like, oh, but
you,
I'm going to drink some tea.
You look and I read. How's that?
No, I got it. I got it, Hatter. I might just, if you hear a pause, I muted myself, but I think I'll be okay.
Okay.
It says so in a book by Jay Hatter. He did not think to run when he saw them arrive. In Wonderland, he said when asked, so not to tell a lie. I'm looking for a little girl. Her name is Alice Little. She's only about this small, I said, as far as I could tell. Now or then, she likes to pretend. It's a game we like to play. She's 9 or 10, I'm not sure when, we will celebrate her unbirthday. She grows too tall and sometimes small, depends on what she took. She likes to play the queen's croquet. It says so in the book. They did not try to help. They said I was a danger. They did not believe a word I said, and I could not have been more stranger. They told me to raise my hands up high above my head. They arrested me for suspicion, endangerment, they said. I rarely leave Wonderland, and this is a reason why. The cops told me to go on home, or I'd have facing 3 to 5. They called in a mug shot, for the record they said I made. I don't remember even singing or what song it was I played. I have to wear this bracelet, and I cannot leave the woods. I cannot leave my Wonderland. They say it's for my own good. So I wait for my Alice. I pray that she is fine. I hope to find her in her dreams because she's missing mine. And she's missing in mine, I apologize. And the poem. I love it.
Thank you.
My favorite line, you know what it's going to be, right?
Your favorite line?
Yeah. If you guess this one.
Was the one I put the weird word in?
No, it says so in the book.
Oh,
first of all, I love that picture.
Of
yeah, I love that picture, but I really love it says it in the book because every time someone says, like today, someone said, oh, the Black Cauldron, I'm like, actually, did you know that is a book? And it's actually a series of books, and the first one was actually the book of three, and it was a Paladin series. And they're just looking at me like, why are you telling me all this information? And I'm like, because you're telling me about a great movie, but it's actually a great series.
It's a lie.
So I just love, yeah, where my mind ascends. My mind ascends is always, oh, it's in this book. So I just love that line. But I thought this was really cool. I love how you twisted the story. I love the photo. I think I said that already, but I know it's one of your drawings. And I love how you kind of made this, like, the cops told me to go home, and they have, like, that the wrist bracelet, tracking bracelet things, and it could be, like, perhaps someone's really a real reality of someone who's twisted and is, like, what's happening here. It's like a Wonderland gone bad, like the cops are coming and he's searching for his Alice, and he doesn't, you know, depends what she took. Again, another one, another maybe innuendo. So I just thought it was really, funny and clever. Thank you, Heather.
Yeah, pretty much hits on, if you were to write that story today, you would be investigated.
Yeah.
Bunch of adults lying to her, taking her, take these mushrooms, you know. Yeah.
I've seen some dark versions. So yeah, I forget what film it was in, but I've seen a darker version of it. And now I can't think of what the name of it was. Raconteur, what do you think?
This is great, Hatter. I mean, you know, it's out and it ties right into her Fantastical Beasts. So, you know, very right on top, whether you think so or not. You know, this is cool, you know, the whole Alice story and sometimes she's little, her size, depending on what she takes. You know, the whole nine yards, very clever. And, you know, you got the story behind it, too. It says so in the book. You know,
yeah. Well, you know, there was two stanzas that I took out, describing the being wanted for searching for a little girl that isn't mine. You know.
Oh, I had to stop. God, that's really dark. What was that? I think I had wrote a dark Alice poem. It's not even published here on All Poetry. It was a long time ago. And it was about how people replace reality. You know, they replace bad things that happen with fantasy, right? And it was along those lines of, it was pretty dark. But it probably wasn't even that good. So I don't even know where that is.
Yeah.
It's a fun topic to play with. But I have 3 minutes left, so yeah. I want to thank, and Hatter, you called in pretty early today too. You had a whole hour with us, and you were listening too. I appreciate that. I do want to thank Raconteur and Hatter for calling in and reading and having wonderful conversations and supporting me and having, I said wonderful conversations already, but I'm going to say it again. That was it. So I was looking for a closeout song, and I was a little frazzled before I called because I got behind more than I thought I was. But I just thought I have this in the studio all the time because I never take it out, and I just thought we should really listen to Candy Candido. And as soon as I say that, Raconteur's probably going to know what it is. Candy Candido was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. His legal name is John B. Candido, was the bassist and vocalist in Ted Fiorito's big band, and they can be seen in a sundial, Ma, He's Making Eyes at Me. He was a childhood friend of Louis Prima, becoming part of the band in 1924. And if you still don't know who he is, just think 1950s Bugs Bunny cartoon. He was the homeless hare. He also was in Fox. He voiced the bear and the fox and the hound. He was one of the goons in the original Sleeping Beauty, Maleficent. He has done so many voiceovers. He was a peg-legged bat, who I love, Fidget. And
are you talking about Michael J. Fox? Are you talking about Michael J. Fox?
No.
Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about Candy Candido. Candy Candido.
Oh, okay.
He has done so many voices for Walt Disney. It's unbelievable. But I think one of my favorite – oh, he was the apple tree in The Wizard of Oz. But I think my favorite is – yeah, my favorite is the Great Mouse Detective. But I love this – I love this, and I've played it before, and I'll probably play it again because I just absolutely love this song. And without further ado, you know what it is, right? You know what it is.
Go for it.
Okay, here we go.
A little man walked up and down and found an eating place in town. He looked the menu through and through to see what 15 cents could do. One meatball. He could afford but one meatball. He told a waiter near at hand the simple dinner he had planned. The folks were startled one and all to hear that waiter loudly call.
One meatball. Hey, this here gent wants one meatball.
The little man, he felt ill at ease and said, "Some bread, sir, if you please." The waiter's voice roared down the hall.
You get no bread with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. You get no bread with one meatball.
Mighty sad, 'cause one meatball was all he had. Now in his dreams he hears the call, you get no bread
with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. You get no bread with one meatball. One meatball.
One meatball.
You get no bread with one.
Can change his voice like that. I mean, just one setting. I love that man. I just think he's so wonderful. And I'm pretty sure, I don't want to say the wrong information, though, but I'm almost positive he was All Dogs Go to Heaven. Into Heaven. Do you remember that film?
Yeah.
So if you remember, I think it's him. I just really hate to say. Yeah. So if you remember the crocodile who's under the sewer, I am almost positive it is him. You know, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure. So if I'm not, I'll correct myself tomorrow if I'm not correct. But I'm pretty sure he is the voice of the crocodile, which makes it relatable because we had crocodiles on Moose tonight. Right? Hatter, did you absolutely love that? That was one guy singing that.
Yeah.
That was the same voice.
Oh, is that right? Oh.
Yes, it was. Oh, wow. I was wrong. It's Ken Page. Man, it wasn't. It wasn't him. See, I was like, I don't know. All right. So
Ken Page.
Ken Page was the guy who did the crocodile and all the ups go to heaven. But Kenny Candido did do a lot, and I love that version. I'm going to send you a link, Hatter. You can watch him live. You'll absolutely love it. I'm gonna close out. Hatter, stick around, because I'm going to send you a link, and you got to click it, okay? It's really fun to watch.
Okay.
Thank you so much, guys. I'll see you tomorrow.